side, and I guess they're all at HoneyNet, so we just go on here. Yeah, welcome to our speech at Black Hat, ladies and gentlemen. I'm FX, this is my co-speaker Kimo, and we're talking about attacking networked embedded systems. We're covering all kinds of stuff, and hope you enjoy the talk, and now I pass it on to Kimo.
Okay, can everybody hear me? Okay. As FX said, we're going to talk about attacking network embedded systems, and specifically I'll be covering some design failures in embedded systems, and then walk through exploitation of some design failures, and then when I'm finished, FX will take over and he'll talk about software. He'll cover vulnerabilities in software and then actually do a walkthrough of taking advantage of a software vulnerability in a commonly used embedded system. First, before we start, we have to define embedded systems. Lots of people have their own definitions. For the purpose of this talk, FX and I are going to say an embedded system is some type of computer in a small electronic device. This can be a Coke machine that lets the warehouse know when it's out of Coke. It can be your 7 Series BMW that tells you where you have to take the left turn or how many miles until you run out of gas. Or it can be a dedicated traditional computer-type device, such as a firewall, that has one sole purpose. Usually the embedded systems run a customized operating system that is either designed specifically for whatever purpose it is that the device is doing, or it is a commonly used operating system that's been heavily modified. In the case of the medical care industry, a lot of stuff like heart-lung machines and stuff like that run on NT. It's been ripped apart really hard, but it's actually NT at the core. A lot of times there's no separation between the actual components and the different access levels of the device, something you see in a normal computer. You've got different access levels and privileges for different types of things that the device will do. In embedded systems, usually this is not the case. It's got a single purpose, and there's an access level, not plural, and that's it. Also, they're difficult to upgrade. We're talking like firmware-style upgrades or an actual changing out of chips or however the device is designed. If it's the hard disk or whatever, the actual upgrade may entail removing the hard disk and replacing it with an updated version. Okay, things that we've seen as design failures that we're going to cover here is items like undocumented functionality, standards that are totally ignored, or an uncontrolled complexity of the actual device. Things like ignored standards there, we're talking if anybody uses Finger on a Cisco device, you know, you finger the Cisco, and it'll turn around and tell you what sessions are active, and that's it, and it closes the connection. That is not the way that Finger is supposed to function according to the protocol, the standard itself. It's supposed to do other things. Developer backdoors, a lot of times a piece of software gets developed and rolled out, and maybe some big customer, whoever uses it, tests it. The developers have backdoors in there so they can get in and do software maintenance. And then down the road, 10 years, the company's been sold 2 or 3 times. The developer's gone, and those backdoors are still in there. Every once in a while, everybody reads Bug Track, you see some of these back doors coming to light. That's just a natural occurrence because of, and loss of control of the development or whatever it is, but it's something that happens actually quite often. Also, legacy functions, something that was needed way back, let's say 10 years ago, that's not needed anymore today, because today nobody uses whatever it is as a function. Complexity, I think everybody here knows about marketing and how everybody wants to be first to market, and we're going to add this new functionality, we're going to make it Bluetooth accessible or whatever it is, and everybody adds this. It gets added really quick. A lot of times when people do this, they don't pay attention to the original design and the way the device itself was designed and the way access was set up on it, and this gets ignored and they add this new piece to it and it doesn't fit in. And that's where you start running into problems. The first one we're going to talk about is the Lucent Brick. This is a National Security Agency approved firewall. It's a layer 2 firewall, also certified by NCSA. It suffers what we think are a few design failures in the design of the ARP cache itself. First off, it will forward ARPs regardless of the rules that you set up in the firewall. It really doesn't care. It will forward the ARPs. So you can do like an ARP sweep instead of a ping scan to identify other devices in the area. Another problem is ARP reply poisoning. Do you want to hit the first one? If you look down in the corner there, the ARP reply poisoning, the cloud, we're just going to say that's the internet or the area outside the firewall. At that point, an attacker can sit there and just send an ARP reply with a spoofed IP address of the LSMS management server that is a management station for the brick. It uses this LSMS server to control the firewall. You log to the LSMS server. You can control globally. You can control 100 different firewalls across your enterprise network with this LSMS server. The brick knows who its management server is. However, if you reply with an ARP reply and spoof the IP address of the management server and send a different MAC address, for example, yours or whoever's, it doesn't really matter, it will stop speaking to its management server. This means the firewall just stopped logging, and the firewall team can't access their own firewall. They've got to, like, physically go find it and have somebody power cycle it or whatever. You cut it off. Okay, wait. Another thing is go back. The ARP cache won't time out. This isn't usually a problem. However, in the case of the brick, if you fill up the table with ARPs, the brick will crash. It gives you a nice blue screen background. It's not Windows-based, but it'll give you a blue screen and crash. It dumps right there. This is supposed to be fixed, so you know the vendor has been in contact with us. It's supposed to be fixed in the current version that's coming out right now. I believe they started advertising it last week, so you might want to upgrade. The next example we're going to use is the Ascend router. What we're talking about here is devices that run the Taos operating system, TAOS, not the Max TNT. This device doesn't run Taos. We're talking about Maxes, though. We're talking about the DSL terminators, the cell pipes, that whole line of products. The Ascend routers use an undocumented discovery protocol. It runs over the discard port. You send a specially formed packet, and the device tells you who it is, what cards it has in it, if it's got IPsec cards, if it's got T1 cards, whatever. It'll give you all kinds of information about it. It's listed up there. You can also reset the IP address and the name using this undocumented discovery protocol with an SNMP write. You just give it its new name and IP address, and it says thank you and changes. So that's what we consider a less than ideal reaction from something that has a T1 card in it. Okay, HP printers. We're going to move on to HP printers. I think everybody's seen those and everybody has them. Generally speaking, I'm going to be talking about the networked HP printers. However, some of this stuff applies to all HP printers and some applies to other printers. I'll mention that when it occurs. The HP network printers you can access, as most people know, they have a web interface. A lot of the nice bigger ones have web interfaces. You can surf right into them, and I'm sure a lot of you have probably wondered about the security there. So did we. You can also telnet into them. You can FTP to them. You can play tricks with them with SNMP, etc. There are access restrictions. There are IP-based access restrictions on these devices. Their password set for the PGL security password, for example, PGL, is the printer job language. There is passwords set there. There's ways to restrict access via IP, and there's actual admin passwords on the device using the different access methods. The problem that we found is these are inconsistent, extremely inconsistent. You can take an SNMP read and snatch the web-based admin password off the device. It's just in hex. I think the address is up there. That's where you've got it. It's in hex. So just take the via SNMP, snatch the web-based password. Once you have that, you just surf to the device and you own it. You just log in as username LaserJet, not admin. We tried that over and over and over. That doesn't work. The username is LaserJet. Once you're in, you own the device. You control this device. Yeah. Right. Important here is that you can see, because of the different levels of passwords and IP restrictions and everything, somebody actually thought about security. And somebody thought about easy use and different ways you can get in. Unfortunately, we imagine the two developer groups didn't talk with one another. So what you end up with is complex different levels of access that are different from one another, and one can be used to break all of them. Okay, PGL, printer job language. I mentioned this just a few minutes ago. It operates on port 9100, and this gives you access to the configuration. This is like the part where you tell it, take paper from tray one or print it in best quality or in cheap quality or whatever. This is what gives you that access. The security for this relies all on a single password. The password is a number between 1 and 65,535. So it'll take you about 6 hours to brute force at worst. That's the worst case. So that security we don't feel is all that good. Okay, next, PJL. What is this? This gives you access to the actual file system on the printer. Think of the printer now like a Unix system, if you will. Okay, it's got a file system. This is where the spool jobs are kept. This is where macros are kept. If you've got like a legal office, you've got the little headers for the letterhead for everything. You can actually do PCL macros for that type of stuff and store that in there. That's where all of this stuff is kept. In the newer models of the printers, there's a lot more file system content. You've got your web server, so you've got like web pages. You've got all your content. You've got all the subsystem stuff is all located there. It's an actual file system that you can go into. You want to flip it real quick? And it is a file server. Using a tool that we've developed, this is a shot of the actual file system. And you can see there's two volumes, volume zero up top and then volume one. And you can actually see the content there. There's directories identified by a D. That was real hard to figure out. There's text files, there's logs, there's objects. You've got subdirectories for different items. The spool's down below on a different volume. Okay, so we figured we've got this PGL, so we'll develop a tool to make it easier to use, because telnetting in over port 9100 and trying to figure out how to work everything is kind of a pain. So we figured we'd make it a little bit easier. Some of our goals. We want to make it easy to use. We want to be able to read and modify all the content on this file system. So we want full access. We decided we'd add in something to break the passwords, because why should I use my laptop to break the password when I can use your printer to break your own password? It's easier that way. You can change the messages, which created a lot of frustration for the company where we work at, because they kept going up to the printer and it said, please insert coin in the display, and was flashing our names instead of printer ready. So you can have a lot of fun with this thing. So that was part of the background of this. We wanted it to be easy to use. One member of the group, FTR, he'll be speaking later at DEF CON, he actually wrote a GUI that wraps up this, and it's PFT, the printer frustration tool. This is the main menu here. We've blocked out the IP addresses, because you wouldn't believe how many printers, HP printers, you can find on the internet if you just happen to accidentally surf port 9100 and see how many you can find out there. There's a lot of printers that at that high level aren't blocked. Next, we've got a interface to the actual, like a file browser, if you will, a Windows Explorer, to make it easy. Like you have your exploit and you want to upload it, so you want it to look like Windows Explorer, right? So you just grab it and click and move your exploit up onto the printer device. And then we've got access to the actual environment variables. And this is where you can play with stuff like if the CEO sends a print job, send it somewhere else or print it in reverse colors or give the secretary 35,000 copies of every document she prints. And it's a good way to test printer memory. Okay, moving on. Something else that we picked up on, ChaiVM. ChaiVM is a Java virtual machine developed by Hewlett-Packard. It's used not just by HP now, it's used by other vendors as well. This actually runs on embedded systems, and it's a fully functional Java virtual machine. We've listed some of the printers that we found it on that run it and support it fully. When it's installed on a printer, like some of these ones listed here, it comes fully functional. It comes with all the objects, a populated web server, the whole nine yards. It's really cool. It's already loaded for you on the printer. And all of this stuff lives on that file system that we showed you before. It's all there, and so you can like surf to it and change it whatever way you want. This is a statement from the HP website, and something that we found interesting was the last three lines. These appliances are powered by HP Chai embedded software. It doesn't say these printers. It says these appliances. And some people are real proud that this virtual machine runs on lots of different devices. We found it on a few, but we've only tested it on printers at this point. So how does it work? Okay, first, your printer will come with a standard loader service. It's called this.loader. That's an actual, you can see it's a web address on your printer. You just go there and that's it. It's this.loader. That's the original one. The idea was it's supposed to validate the jar signatures when you upload stuff. It didn't work real good. It's like really bad. And so HP developed something new, and it's called Easy Loader. This Easy Loader is a signed jar itself. And once this is uploaded and executed on the printer, you can upload other jars without worrying about the signatures, which is real important in a few minutes here. That's the easy way to do it. The other way is accessing through the printer itself, just going directly to the services. You see the path there, that volume zero with CS config. That config is actually just a flat file. That's a config file, like something you'd find in the etc directory that you can take and play with any way you want and change it to do whatever you want. If you have a question, HP's website has lots of information. They'll teach you how to work all that stuff and do everything. You can just download it all. So the goal, getting our code onto our printer. The first thing you have to do, you've got this.loader, which isn't ideal. We want Easy Loader on there, so we upload Easy Loader. Once we've got Easy Loader uploaded and executed, we're good. We can upload our jar because it's not going to check the signatures anymore of the future jars. So that's it. That's all there is to it. This is the easy way. The manual way, if you don't have like the printer frustration tool or an easier way, just surfing into it and uploading it with the web interface that HP has, you can manually upload all your class files to the printer onto the volume. Just upload them. Download the CS config file that we showed. Modify that, edit it to do whatever you want, upload it again, and force the printer to reload, and that's it. Your changes are effective. So that's all there is to it. It's actually pretty simple. Things that we noticed, ChaiVM is very unstable. If you get too many threads, it just dies. It just dies. Our secretary, I can't tell you how many times our secretary got a call and late in the afternoon, could you please go over and power cycle the printer again? It was testing was really, because we don't have like these huge printers at home to play with. If you send a connect to an unreachable host or a service that's unreachable on a port, the device will also crash. It just dies. It doesn't always give you an exception. Sometimes it's just gone. Sometimes it'll throw an exception and terminate halfway decently. It's really unstable in that respect, and we haven't been able to figure out what. And we haven't been able to reproduce it effectively to determine why it's doing what it's doing. HP has a simulation environment, which is cool, that you can download. It's for developers and whatnot. You can go to their website, or at least 2 weeks ago it was still there. They're probably taking it off the site right now. But you can download the simulation environment Unfortunately, the simulation environment doesn't work like the actual devices. The devices are extremely unstable, and the simulation environment's real cool and never crashes, and it's real nice. If you try this at home, you'll need that last line. It's in your notes too that they gave you, because you'll end up having to reset the printer quite often, and that's what you need to do to reset the device itself. Okay, so we can get code on the printer, but we didn't have any code to put on the printer that would run on an HP. So we wrote some. We've got a port scanner you can upload to your printer and use your printer to port scan the network, right? It's web-based to make it really easy. Just point and click. It goes with the PFT tool that we wrote. ChiCrack, what I mentioned earlier, to let the printer do the cracking for you, you shouldn't have to waste your laptop CPU power when you can use their printers to crack passwords for you. You can write your own backdoor servers, install them on the printer, and have it sitting there listening for you. You can do anything you want. Anything you can normally do in Java, you can try. And hey, try it. It's cool. All you have to do, you may have to reset your printer, right? That's it. So just try it. If nothing else, go over and power cycle the printer or issue a reset. This is a screenshot from the crack tool that was developed to run on the printers. Go ahead. I'm going to close it up here. One thing that we notice is that all these Chai services trust each other. They're all interrelated, and they fully trust each other, and it's real scary because there's a lot of other services that HP has. We've listed a few of them here. There's a neat service that will notify you when something interesting happens, like the CEO is there after 6 o'clock and sends a print job. Cool, I want to know about that, because like if maybe the company's not doing good, that could have serious effect, and it'll notify you. It can like send you an email, which is a neat function. Another email function that we found extremely scary is the last one there that you see, this Chai Mail. It's specifically designed to work effectively with firewalls. Your printer will pull a pop mail account outside the firewall. You get into your printer, you configure it to pull your pop mail account, and then you send your pop mail account commands. Use your commands to your printer by sending mail to an account outside the firewall. The printer checks mail, finds a command, and executes it, which is real cool. You really need to pay attention to layered security. This is where those people that really have heavy layered security will do better than the rest of the people, because it goes right through the firewall. Okay, if you want the source, it is open source, of course. If you want the source or any of the tools, they're available at that URL. There's no links right now, I don't think, on the website, but if you go to that URL, you'll find the stuff. It's live there on the website now. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to FX, and he's going to go in deeper now into some of the issues related to software. Okay, thank you.
You burned 20
minutes.
Okay, so after the fun part, we're going to be a bit more serious in software vulnerabilities. Let's talk a little bit about it. Actually the same classes of vulnerabilities are found in embedded systems that you usually find in normal operating systems. Of course, you have the classic input validation issues. I personally saw format string issues in like next to every embedded system that does logging. Buffer overflows are real common, and of course they were shown on Bugfix over time, got released. And yes, you can do cross-site scripting on embedded systems. Actually, the HP printers we just talked about are affected. You can do cross-site scripting on them. Scary is most of the embedded HTTP daemons I played with have vulnerabilities, and that's all simple stuff like overlong URIs and like long CGI parameters. That just crashes the device. And because of embedded systems being normally a bit smaller than normal computers, engineers try to save every byte, and that's normally deciding against additional security or sanity checks. So Here are some examples of buffer overflows we found. First, Zedia routers, today called Lucent Access Points, is one example of these vulnerable HTTP daemons. It's an excellent router, actually. I really like it, but if you like go there and do a GET request with like 4,000 characters, it just dies. So that's not real good. The brother network printers, they have a comparable issue that basically you have the web interface and it asks you for a password. You put in like some 100 characters and the printer crashes. HP Proco switch have a neat little issue with SNMP stuff because normally you can do a lot of stuff with SNMP write, but if you put in that specific variable over here, like 85 characters, the device doesn't crash right now. It crashes next time the admin tries to access it. That's pretty neat. And even totally small devices with the size of a cigarette pack, for all these non-smoking Americans, that's the size of a cigarette pack. Even these ones have today like web service and all kinds of stuff, and even these are vulnerable to totally simple overflow attacks. That's that strange German print device we're talking about, and it's pretty nice because it hangs off the printer Centronics port, and as soon as that device crashes, your printer crashes. Common misconceptions when it comes to exploitation of embedded systems. Well, most people think it's harder to do than a multi-purpose operating system. And yeah, you don't have like the classic concept of a shell. So what are you going to do with your code, even if you get it running on the system? You don't know how that all works internally. You don't know where the chips are. You don't know what the syscalls are. That's always a problem. And anyway, I mean, the worst thing that can happen is, like, your device crashes. Well, we would like to show that this is not a good reason, none of it, not try it, and you might even be successful. As an example, we picked the Cisco Internetwork Operating System, or iOS, running on the Cisco routers. The goal here is actually that you have a single vulnerability, and the goal is to show that actually a single vulnerability can indeed lead to full exploitation of the device. So some general things we have to keep in mind here. First, the whole thing is one big piece of software. So as soon as something feels unhappy, it's going to crash, and everyone who has Cisco routers knows that. The iOS is available for all kinds of different platforms, so we should look into something that's general, that applies to like all of them. And of course it's not open source, so you can't just like surf to ios.sourceforge.net and check out how it looks like. You have to do that a bit different. So, according to Cisco, the by far most common problem in iOS is related to memory corruptions. That's how they say that. So while there are many different ways of memory corruptions, we can safely assume that a vulnerability with something put in that's too big is probably the characteristic of a heap overflow. So, well, of course, you always need the vulnerability to research something like that. And yeah, so we figured we use that TFTP one here. It's not widely used, so initial exposure should be minimal. The issue here, if you go TFTP server on iOS and you request a file and you have like a huge file name, it crashes. And that's down here. Unfortunately, I can't laser point. That's basically one snap of what's shown on the console when it crashes. So let's just check out what we can do with that. Oh yeah, that's fun part. The Cisco TFTP advisory, by the way, not having any credits for us, just to quote that, even they think the worst thing that can happen is your Cisco crashes. Well, understanding the memory layout. with a huge chunk of binary data, like the iOS images, you can just like disassemble it, and of course that would be illegal, and we don't want to do that. So, what you do is, one way is you put debug output, memory dumps, and core files together, and other sources of information as Cisco's troubleshooting web pages. And yeah, from the crash output of the console we showed before, we can already see something quite interesting. We have a block magic that like tells you, okay, here begins the memory block. This 2 over here is probably the process ID of the thing that died. Then another pointer block higher up in memory, that actually if you look at that memory place also has that block magic, is probably the next block. So the following is probably the previous block. Good assumption. And then we have that size field over here, that has a quite funny most significant bit set. And so educated guess is that this most significant bit is used for like this memory block is in use. So to make sense of it, we have to check the memory addresses commonly used in the devices. Again, we serve to Cisco's web page, and we use some normal commands like show proc CPU, show mem allocating process, stuff like that. And one can easily validate that these are correct or not. And of course, the most interesting part for us is the NVRAM address, because that's where the juicy part is stored. So what we know so far is this. We have that magic number, as described on the Cisco webpage. We have the PID, some pointers, we don't actually know what they are used for. The address of the string used for show mem allocating process. The next pointer, the previous pointer, the size field with that assumed usage bit, a field called RFCNT. For me, that sounds like reference count. And of course, the red zone, which is used as a canary and yeah, to check if you actually have memory problems. Now, here's what we plan to do. We fill the memory block that is used to store our legitimate data. And since we're literally sitting in there, we call it the host block. He's friendly to host us. We append the made-up block header to it and write this one over the original block header of the next block. And that's how it is supposed to work. Now, we try to make iOS use this header information and hope for something that has a comparable behavior to, like, malloc-free exploits on Linux. The desired result, of course, is writing to arbitrary memory addresses. During our research, we found the following about these blocks. When iOS frees memory block, the element is removed from a linked list. So actually, there is a pointer exchange taking place over here. And that's basically how it looks like. The previous next pointer, now points to the next memory block. And the next previous pointer points to the next pointer of the previous block. Basically, I think the graphic is way better than my explanation. This is basically what we are looking for. So, yeah, maybe we can use that for something. Now to some tricky part that really required some time. Find out what is required. What does iOS really check? The magic is checked. The PID and these strange other memory addresses are not. Surprisingly, the next pointer is not checked. The previous pointer, on the other hand, has to be 100% correct. The size field is checked and should not contain any bogus values, like huge values or something. Then, of course, iOS will not like it. And of course, that red zone is checked because that's what it is for. So question is, what's checking that? There is a process on iOS called check heaps, which actually makes sure that everything still looks the way it should be. And if not, you just hit a software forced crash. So on top of that, for these fields, some of them are actually checked during allocation and freeing of memory blocks. So if unhappy, iOS crashes, usual behavior. But hey, I mean, from that picture, we can overflow up to the next pointer, actually, and so we can influence one of two pointers using in a pointer exchange. Which leads us to the next slide. Let's take the first victim. Cisco 2500 allows direct writes to the NVRAM memory, which is quite nice. We simply place the address of the NVRAM in an X pointer, doing the overflow. And since we're doing a string overflow, we don't actually append these red zeros over there. And the last two bytes are just what's left over from the old pointer, so we just hope it's not a high number. And yeah, for the pointer exchange, it takes place. The linked list removal takes place. And this unknown previous pointer is directly written into the NVRAM, which has a nice effect. Because what happens is this. We send that little fake block thing over there. Then the NVRAM checksum is no longer valid. So first it figures, oops, memory problem, reboots. After the reboot, it realizes, oops, NVRAM no longer valid. So it goes out, asks on the network for a configuration, and of course we are going to happily provide one. Here we go. You just owned a Cisco router. Let's review what we have done here. We've used the buffer overflow and a fairly common method. I mean, that's not black magic, to invalidate the NVRAM. So the attack has some disadvantages, of course. The NVRAM is only directly writable on the 2500. And, of course, the attacker has to be in the same subnet to provide that config. Or, of course, own the TFTP server. But the attack has also some advantages. You don't need any specific knowledge other than the overflow length. Everything else is well known. And the attacker doesn't need shellcode at all. I mean, there are no limitations on what to do, and the config can be as big as you want. So far, so good. So, of course, if you feel like it, you can use that as a nice permanent remote denial of service attack. But who wants to do that anyway? Okay, to get us any further, we have to deal with this previous pointer issue. The iOS detects the memory issues when checking our host block, not the one we are writing on. So to test, the test seems to check if the previous pointer of the next block points back to where iOS obtained its address from in the first place. This is hard to come by, but what we can do is we can put the system in a fairly predictable state by crashing it once. So after the reboot, it is fairly predictable. And if we can get hold of some crash information sent to a syslog host, like by means of interception, protocol-based attacks, or just owning the syslog host itself, we can actually get these pointer values, so we are safe on that side. Another issue we're facing for exploitation of other Cisco devices is that size field. That bit 31 marks usage or no usage, as we already figured out. These 0 bytes in there prevent us from using the real or close to real values because we're doing a string overflow, and as everyone knows, 0 bytes and a string are really bad. But if we take the minimum value for the use block, we hit a fairly high number, this one over here, and it doesn't really make sense to iOS, so iOS will bitch about it. But funny enough, if we put that 7FFF stuff in there, iOS does not complain. Obviously, some 32-bit calculation is used here, and yeah, everything is fine now. So we got rid of that one. Since that size field trick doesn't have the most significant bit set, we should look a bit into the free blocks, because that's what we are claiming to be, a free block. So after the already discussed overhead, there is some more for free memory addresses. There is another magic called dead beef, another address in code space somewhere, padding, more padding, talk about effective coding. Another next pointer, we call it a free next pointer since it's only existing in free blocks. And another previous pointer, which we obviously called free brief. These two pointers point at other blocks that are free, so one can suspect they're used the same way as the previously discussed next and previous pointers, just in a linked list for some memory organization and stuff. So, hey, like we were asking for it, these two pointers are not checked at all. So, the pointer exchange, similar to the one we had before, takes place. That one is probably used to merge free blocks, but yeah, who cares? The value of the free next is written directly to the place free previous is pointing to. The value of free previous is written to where free next plus 20 bytes is pointing to. So here's our way to write arbitrary pointers to arbitrary memory addresses in iOS. Of course, it is required that both values also represent writable memory. Otherwise, you hit access errors or write protect errors. How does that come from? Okay. So let's go on. So where could we put these pointers? I mean, we need like a good place to put them. There is a memory block in every iOS that's called process array. Hello. It is an obvious array of memory addresses and has exactly the same number of elements as you have number of processes on your device. Each address has some kind of process record sitting in. It's like a huge block of data and contains all kinds of values. But the first value in that block is the same thing you see when you do show memory allocating process that stays out and says process stack. So the second value actually is inside that block. So the assumption is pretty good. The second value is the stack pointer. These values do not change per iOS image. So if you have an iOS image, these pointers, these addresses will be static. Perfect. Now we have some pretty good idea where to put these pointers we use in a pointer exchange. So what we do, obviously, we take the processor. The memory management using our pointers is allowed to write to the stack. Good. The stack contains the saved stack pointer. Thank you. The stack also contains the return address. Excellent. We can use, I mean, now we have like a huge list of choices. We can use the stack of the process that's currently not active or not very active, but hopefully becomes active in the future. And we just hit the return address right away and take the CPU. Or we overwrite the stack pointer on the stack and provide a new stack. We overwrite the stack pointer and or the stack segment in a process block. Or we right away overwrite the process array entry and create like a total new process record with all the information in it. Unfortunately, we don't really know what to put in there. So, well, at this point, we got some more problems, unfortunately. When we do our overflow, a free, which we are using here, actually cleans the memory. It's free. Oops. So that's not a place to leave buffer code or anything else. But the content of the fake block we are providing is considered already clean. So here's where the exploit buffer is. And the best is, for a specific vulnerability, this offset is static. So taking all these little facts together, we came up with an example for the Cisco 1600 series. It runs on a Motorola CPU, which really got me because I didn't know about Motorola assembly before at all. This CPU supports write-protected memory. That is the reason why we can just put the NVRAM address in the next pointer and do that local attack. But this protection, according to the Motorola manual, is actually set in some base register, and we found that base register at the address you're seeing here on the third point. Only thing we have to do is we modified bit 1 to be 0 instead of 1, which means not write-protected. And NVRAM is no longer write-protected then, and we just write some crap in there. This is basically how the shellcode looks like, if you want to call it a shellcode. You see it's fairly small. The first two lines write-enable the NVRAM. The next two lines trick the NVRAM address, which is 0xOE and a bunch of zeros, which is bad for the overflow, into the A1 register. And the last line writes something into the NVRAM. Now, we did a more complicated approach by putting the pointers this way, that the free actually would write into our shellcode the line, that funny move over there that goes to D1, is actually the place where the second pointer is going to be stored, and I just wanted to show how to do that and how to get rid of some data written directly into your exploit code. You just have some opcode which uses that as an argument and do some innocent thing with it. To summarize it, that's how you get the 1600. You overflow once, so it reboots. You overflow again, this time with the correct previous pointer. This is a hard part. That funny size field, the and VRAM invalid, cries for help, and you provide it. Okay, to go further, actually we need some more info on iOS that's not well known. It uses some kind of cooperative multitasking. Actually, it looks more like a huge program that kicks off parts of it using interrupts all the time. It really relies on interrupts. And this NVRAM checksum that's always invalid when the device reboots is actually a 16-bit checksum, a once complement checksum as found in IP. So it's not too hard to calculate that one. It also contains like the size of the config and information on why the system crashed last time, including stack traces and all kinds of stuff. So the config is basically a long string for iOS. It's terminated by that well-known end keyword and a 0 byte, and that's pretty much it. So equipped with all that information, we can just as well write a shellcode that enables us to take remote devices. All we have to do is carry the config with us and the backpack of the shellcode. We disable the interrupts so nobody interrupts us. We unprotect the NVRAM, calculate the NVRAM checksum, the new one, and just write the config. And just to be nice, we do a clean reset of the device afterwards. So we have these typical shellcode issues here. First of all, these annoying 0 bytes. We basically took the total classic approach of self-modifying code. The bootstrap code does not contain any 0 bytes and basically decodes the rest of the code and the config. And for this particular vulnerability, you shouldn't use the classic checkerboard 5-5 hex pattern, because that creates some colons, and colons are used as separation in the TFTP file, and that screws your exploit. Back in game. So we got around that annoyance. We have another one, because these NVRAM chips aren't really fast. I mean, they're real slow. You can't just write a big bunch of data to it. And the manual for that funny one here we found in the 1600 after unscrewing it and finding the right chip is actually saying you should keep the address line straight and poll that data register that tells you if the data is actually written or not. But hey, I don't know where that is. And you can just as well do the simple solution and delay after write and just figure out a good number for it. And that's what we did. So this is how it finally looks like. You have your overflow, you have the fake block, bootstrap code, XOR code, new config. For the code we release, you just specify the IP address and a new config file in the command line. at a good previous pointer value, fire it off, and yeah, you have your new config uploaded to the router. That's basically how that looks. You see, no more crying for help. It just did a clean reboot, all happy about it. You see the new config was a bit smaller because, yeah, it is also priced to find a BRI interface on a 1600. And, yeah, then you just telnet to it, and, of course, you provided the password, so there's your router. So here is some simple snippets from the code. Actually, that's the fake block we're using here. It looks horrible, but it's not. If you look at it like three times, you actually know how that works. It has that red zone over here to terminate the last block, have the magic, have some PID. It's never checked. Next and previous pointer don't really matter here. You have that funny size field again and all kinds of stuff, and at the end you have the two pointers that point to code and stack. That's a snippet of the code. That's actually the part that decodes everything behind it, so that's the self-modification part. It has, again, some self-modification in the self-modification code because, unfortunately, the branch opcode for Motorola does contain 0 bytes, so we had to fix that here. And, yeah, that's how to cleanly reset a 1600 or, for that matter, every device running on that processor. But, of course, I mean, that's not as reliable as a TISO SSH exploit, so there's still a lot of work to do on it. We especially need to compare the workings here with other Cisco heap-based vulnerabilities and see how they differ. We also need a way to deliver stable external buffers, but one can imagine that in the backpack of any protocol message picked up by the Cisco, that shouldn't be a big problem. The previous pointer is still the biggest problem we have and has still to be solved completely because I'm not happy with that reboot method, and yeah, we're working on it. Stay tuned. What's the... Yeah, we need a list of stack addresses per iOS image, of course, because, as I said, they're stable per image, but there are tons of images out there. So, yeah, you have to find that out. And we also need some shellcode, but that's easy. That's writing to flashcards or actually removing traces, like stack traces, so the forensics guy has a real bad day. Or just real-time modify the configuration. I mean, you can just... have a shellcode that removes all access list bindings, replaces the password, and reboots the device. So far, we still have to prove, actually, that this exploitation method works on all iOSs up to 12.2 due to a lack of a vulnerability for 12.2. We couldn't prove that yet. Yeah, yet again, a summarizer of the, what we did and what we tested here. The 1000 series is actually even simpler to exploit because it's nice enough to let you write directly into the exception handler. So as soon as the device finds out that something is screwed up, it will execute your code. Sounds a bit like the Windows exploits, actually. The Cisco 1600 and 2600 are easily exploitable, while the 2600 runs a power processor, so you're not going to use that shellcode here. And the 2500 is not exploitable remotely that way because we still have, your code actually ends up in low memory addresses that have tons of zeros in there. But if you have an overflow that is not stream-based, you can take the 2500 too. And from what one can see from the different memory maps, most of the Ciscos are exploitable this way. Yeah, for everyone who didn't get it yet, there are many buffer overflows in iOS, and on any platform, using such a heap override with a fake block, you can remotely exploit them. There are various different possible attack methods and attack vectors here. You can like inject it via protocols, D debug-based exploitation is good. And yeah, the big problem here is that the network infrastructure still has not gotten enough attention from the security folks. The NVRAM still contains your original config. I mean, for the local network attack where you invalidate the NVRAM, the attacker doesn't just get the router, he also gets your config, including all the passwords, all the routes, all the settings, all the juicy stuff. And of course, you can modify the shellcode to just copy the original config back in NVRAM, because normally you have plenty of space for that, and calculate the right checksum, and here you go. You inspect it after you took the router. Oh, and by the way, that also breaks that no servers password recovery stuff. So if you get locked out of a router, make sure you have TFTP running. Here's a real bad scenario on that one. An attacker takes a branch off his router. This is what we did here. Then the attacker builds himself an IPsec tunnel back to protect the innocent, so he's not seen by the IDS and all these people running honeypots. And yeah, then he goes, takes over your company via his encrypted tunnel. So the question, of course, is how do you protect yourself against it? In general, do not rely on one type of equipment for your protection. If everything on your DMZ and outside perimeter say Cisco, that's not good. Assume that a vulnerability in your networked equipment or embedded system will sooner or later be exploited to the fullest extent. We just wanted to show that it is possible. It doesn't stop anyone from doing remote overflows on, like, your printer. Use all protection an operating system gives you. Like, if you have something where you can set a password, and please not the default password. And don't just overlook simple and small devices. Sooner or later, they will fall victim to someone. And yeah, basically, if you think about how to manage all your devices, remember to do it as secure as possible. Read, don't use Telnet. So for HP printers, check the following. Did you assign an admin password? Did you change the SNMP communities, both of them? Did you enable PGL protection? Actually, that gives you just a bit of time, but it's okay. Use the IP address filter and only allow, like, print servers to talk to the device. If you send a job to the print server first anyway, there is no reason your computer has to talk to the printer directly. And for critical printers, like finance department, you might consider them putting behind IP filter devices, or honestly, just connected to the LPT port. That's what that is for. I mean, you don't have to set it on the network if only one guy is printing on it. For the Cisco routers, the following are additional measures to be taken to prevent your routers to be exploited. Of course, you should do the normal Cisco router hardening anyway. Keep the iOS up to date. I mean, it's painful, I know. And it might even require some money because, yeah, you have to buy new RAM for every new version of iOS. But this is basically the best way to protect yourself. Turn off these unneeded services. I mean, that's like one of the oldest messages in the security community, but it's still not gotten through on, like, routers. Use the signature over here to tell your network-based IDS how a Cisco heap overflow looks like. You can use the command debug sanity, which is, by the way, undocumented, to increase the validation of the memory structures. It actually just prevents, like, less experienced attackers from doing it because the exploitation still works. It catches afterwards. And, of course, make perfectly sure that your logging data doesn't go anywhere. Oh, right, and that config register trick over here is pretty good, but makes maintenance pain in the ass. If you set that in a config, the reboot will not work. It will hang in the ROM mon, which is good to protect yourself from exploitation, but is bad because, yeah, I mean, if you have to reboot it, it will hang in ROM1, and you better have a console cable with you. And really, I cannot resist saying that, but if you have no vulnerabilities in iOS, the presented exploitation method is not going to pose a risk at all. So that was pretty much it. Hope you enjoyed it.